Go, rock and roll.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Lewis and Lucas. I am one of your hosts, Lucas. With me, as always, is Lewis. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing well. How are you doing, Lucas?
I'm good. I'm excited. And I'm excited because you have a book coming out. I'm one of the lucky few who had an opportunity to preview this book. It's very, very interesting. We're going to break it all down. But before we get into the book, people may not know this isn't your first rodeo. You've written other books before. Do you want to give us a kind of a brief synopsis of your authorship?
Yeah. Although it's not a super long list, but last year or the year before, so 2 years ago, I published a book called The Emperor Has No Clothes. And that book was mostly, a lot of different subjects. And it was a discussion on what parts of our current culture, current society, would surprise people either from the past or from the future. So in other words, what are the strange aspects of our culture that will be strange to future generations or past generations? And so I kind of went through everything from the way that we look at, hot button topics like gender and sexuality, to more normal, or I guess less controversial topics like finance and other subjects like that. So basically went through kind of all of society and just said, what are the parts that we're doing that are weird, don't really have a good explanation, and are just somehow we ended up this way that breaks with the way that humans usually do things. And so that was called The Emperor Has No Clothes.
Would you mind giving us an example, like it was a single example of like what's something, maybe something in the modern era that's really strange?
So one of the things that I talk about in that book was the fact that we are specialists when it comes to knowledge. In other words, when you say, we want to learn about poetry, we've got a expert in poetry that came in, and that expert in poetry, the way it works with a PhD is you're not just like a poetry PhD, you're an expert. You write your thesis on 14th century French poetry, right? And, and that's true in almost every field. We've become hyper specialized. So you'll get an expert in not just physics as a whole, you'll get an expert in thermal fluid properties within physics or whatever. So, and across the board, and there's a joke like in medicine, someone will say, I'm an ear doctor, and they'll say, what ear are you a doctor of? Right. Because it becomes very, very specialized, in those areas. And we assume that's good, right? Like we assume, hey, I've become, we really want to understand the right ear. We've got a doctor that's an expert on the right ear. The problem with that, but that's a break from what we've always done for history wise. Like you go to Isaac Newton, genius, right? He in his day was not an expert in one field. We think of him as the guy that discovered physics or whatever, but he actually also was an expert in optics. He discovered some of the best technologies for telescopes, for example. He was an expert in currency. They put him in charge of the exchequer to root out counterfeits of his day. He was an expert in chemistry. He worked with Boyle of Boyle's Law to develop the highest levels of chemistry. He was an expert in math. He was a guy that was, here's the crazy thing about Isaac Newton. He wrote more on the Bible than he wrote on all those other subjects put together. So he's a guy that like truly was a generalist, like a general, a deep generalist. And actually, you go across the board to almost all those people from the early eras and any other era of knowledge, going all the way back to the Greek days. You look at, Aristotle, for example, just a generalist of every sense. We've become specialists. So in my book, I talked about, why what are the downsides to that? And the downsides are you become like an idiot savant. Like if you're familiar with the old 1980s, 1990s movie, Rain Man, where he was like really good at one thing, which was gambling, but he was basically unable to do anything else and unable to change his clothes or whatever. And that's what we become when we do this specialization. And it actually makes us worse at the field that we are in, because what often happens when you're an expert in tons of different fields is you get ideas from some of the fields that you wouldn't think relate, right? If you're an expert in ballet and in physics or whatever, you might like be able to tie, oh, in ballet, this works this way. Maybe, you know, something else is going on here. Like we take those fields that we're generalists in and we tie them all together and we become more creative in the fields that we're in. So it actually, the specialization actually makes us worse in the field that we're a specialist in. And I think that is how we get so much nonsense coming out of academia these days, is that, you know, we get just a lot of people that are
siloed in their own echo chambers.
Yeah. Yeah. And get worse at their own field as a result of that. So,
And to your point, I remember reading an article about how Russian scientists don't have that same specialization, right? Like the chemistry department is right next to the literature department. So they'll be getting coffee together and talking about what they're doing, and they hear how they're approaching a problem in this department has nothing to do with their field, yet they're able to, there's this flow of ideas that they allows them to, what you're saying, the creativity is able to produce a lot of ideas much more better than if they were just to stay in their own echo chamber.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, that certainly helps. So what you'll get in order to deal with what I'm talking about is you'll get corporations or universities that will take specialists and a bunch of different specialists and put them in one room. The problem, and then that's certainly better than having a, you know, a bunch of Rain Men in the room, but it still has that problem of it's not working knowledge within people's heads. So I think it's extremely important that we get away from this specialization and we teach people very broadly, and that if you want to be a knowledgeable person, you should chase knowledge of all kind that you find interesting.
Yes.
Not go to a university. I feel like universities in their current state probably make people stupider. And you know, I say that as someone that's got a lot of education, and I just, I feel like they are, they're
idiot factories.
They're idiot factories. Yeah, they are. They're doing, unfortunately doing harm.
I love what you said there, because that's really what we're trying to do. We have a couple of interests that we share: theology, economics, currents, like all these different things. Neither of us are special. We don't have PhDs in these areas, but as lay people, we also don't cower to the specialists. We want to know and understand these things and flesh them out and challenge ideas, as preposterous as that may be, because of our lack of specialization.
Yeah. Yep.
So go ahead.
Yeah. And I think that when you're a generalist, when you understand a lot of different things, I think you actually have an ability to see the world in a truer way. I think you have the ability to have a perspective on new subjects that other people can't. So
absolutely, I think
it's a really good thing.
So that's a good synopsis of that book, The Emperor Has No Clothes. Any other
books? By the way, I'm not promoting, because I actually am going to rework that book. It is a very long book. So we just gave a nice advertisement for it, but I'm not, it's not something.
Second edition coming to you.
Yeah, much shorter edition, because that is, I had people that were very interested in the subject, read a big chunk of it, said they loved it, but they were like, this is a long book, you know, I'm working through it. And it was a very long book. It was you live and learn as you write. And I killed every subject that I could think of, and threw the kitchen sink at it. And I like the book, but it's just too long. So I'm going to maybe break it into different sections and talk about you know, whatever. But
yeah, for sure. Any other books you want to mention before we get into this newest book?
No, I've written other stuff that I also am not promoting. So like this is my first book where I've said, you know what, I love what I found here. And, you know, getting back to the generalist thing, I don't think I could have found this without being a generalist, without, you know, just from my background. I have an engineering degree, I've got a business degree, I've got a religion degree, and I've got I read a lot on various subjects. And it was through that broadness of reading and study that these themes that I came up with in this book really started to materialize in my mind. And it's a book that I think is an extremely important message for today. And it's a book that I desperately want to get out into the public. Not because I want to sell books. You can't make money selling books, by the way. Unless you're J.K. Rowling, you will be broke selling books. So I'm not trying to make money off this, other than some coffee money or whatever. But like, I want this message to be out there because it's so important for today. So
that's awesome. Very, very awesome. Let's get into it. Let's talk about your book. What's the title? tell us what it's about.
Sure. So the title is The Return of the Dragon. The Shocking Way Drugs and Religion Shape Societies. It's now available for pre-sale. So you can go to Amazon, search for that title. And the last name is Ungit. So if you search for Return of the Dragon, Ungit, U-N-G-I-T, you can find that book and pre-order it. Coming out on the 29th of this month, so August 29th. There's going to be an Audible version of it as well, and a Kindle version. So here's what the book is about, and here's what I've shocked me when I found out the shocking way drugs affect. So I listened to a lot of different stuff. I listened to the Joe Rogan podcast. I listened to various other podcasts. And one of the things that anybody that listens to the Joe Rogan Experience podcast is that he talks about psychedelics all the time, right? Yes. So like it's almost every episode he'll talk about psychedelics. Some kind of comment. He had Richard Dawkins on, and Richard Dawkins is an atheist, obviously. And he mentioned to Richard Dawkins, hey, have you tried DMT? Have you tried ayahuasca? Have you tried taking psychedelics? And, Richard Dawkins said no, but he has Graham Hancock on. Graham Hancock is an author that has written on ancient Mesoamerica. Ancient Mesoamerica did a lot of psychedelics. That was a huge part of their conversation. Joe Rogan talked about, you know, psychedelics quite a bit. One of the interesting things that came up on that was this drug DMT. So there's in the ancient South America, so prior to Columbus showing up, we call it Mesoamerica, there was a drug that was used by the Inca that was called ayahuasca. And ayahuasca it's a pretty amazing that they were able to discover it. It's not like finding a mushroom where, you know, you see people take mushrooms and you can kind of speculate on how people figured out those were psychedelic, right? You ate a mushroom and it gave you a surprising result. But with ayahuasca, it's like a technology. They take tree bark and some other chemicals, they mix them together, they brew them in a certain way, and it refines it down. And the active ingredient is DMT, dimethyltryptamine. But it is a psychedelic of all psychedelics. It's like a unique psychedelic, and the results of it are pretty shocking, pretty amazing. Like when you hear people talk about, and I personally have never done DMT. I've done other psychedelics, but I've never done DMT. But you hear people talk about it. The studies on it are very consistent, where people will see geometry, and the geometry they describe is what you see on the walls of Mesoamerican architecture. Right. So when you see those zigzag lines and those squares and those triangles, you know, you can picture like Aztec art or whatever. That is what people see when they take DMT. But in addition to that, people across backgrounds. So tribes from the Amazon, hippies from the 1960s, modern day atheist skeptics, people across backgrounds, when they take DMT slash ayahuasca, and I'm going to use those terms interchangeably because they are one's the active ingredient for the other. So I'm just, you know, I'll go back and forth. There's some differences because DMT is the synthesized version and the effects are slightly different, but for the most part, they're the same. But when people take DMT, here's the wild thing. They see entities and they describe them as entities or beings or gods or angels or demons. They describe them. Another word they use are elves, or another phrase Rogan uses a lot is machine elves. But they see these entities and they see them in extremely high percentages. So again, regardless of what your background is, where you're from, what culture you're from, what area you're from, you see these entities and the percentage is ridiculous. Like 94% of people see these entities in some way, mm-hmm. shape or form when they take DMT. Now that's true to a lesser degree with other psychedelics. If you take peyote or you take LSD or you take magic mushrooms, sometimes you'll interact with some kind of entity. Sometimes you'll interact with some kind of other being, but with DMT, it's like an immediate portal where people are immediately seeing these entities. Now, what I always assumed, and let me tell the story of this book for a second. So when I heard that on Rogan, found it interesting, kind of forgot about it, right? Like went out of my mind, went on to other subjects, thought about other stuff. I think I was writing my first book back then and just doing all kinds of stuff. But then I started to read a variety of other books. I read Graham Hancock's America Before, which is about Mesoamerican art. And he talks about his DMT experience there. And I found that interesting. And I found some other themes that were interesting there. I read a book called How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan, where he talks about the use of psychedelics. And I found that interesting. But then simultaneously, I started to kind of look into what is the science behind this? Like, why do people see these things? And the studies are amazing. Like, just the studies are almost by themselves worth reading. Like, just it's interesting what people see.
I think that's what's so interesting about your book is, I think, so people who aren't in that psychedelic world, we hear the stories of the elves or the shapes or whatever. We just all write that off as that's just some weird aberrations that some people see. But when you actually looked at the science, the consistency with the patterns that everybody was experiencing is pretty startling.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's the crazy thing. So I wrote it off as just, people, you take a drug and weird stuff happens in your brain. Doesn't that sort of make sense? But the people that take DMT say it's not weird stuff in my brain. These were real beings. This was real stuff. Mm-hmm. So what studies will show is people will say, actually, what I saw was real. And it's not like a dream. So you have a dream and you come back from the dream and you're like, yeah, I kind of forgot what it was and it wasn't real, and I realized the stuff I saw was just in my head, right? But when you come back from DMT, people will be like, no, those beings were actually real stuff. And here's the wild thing. We talked atheism last week. A majority of people that take DMT, actually two-thirds of the people that take DMT, cease being atheists when they were atheists coming in. So you'll be an atheist before you take DMT. You see these entities, and then you cease to be an atheist.
So Christian apologists, take note.
No, yeah. There's more to now that is mind-blowing, right? That's a mind-blowing fact, is that the people that should be the most skeptical, that should be like, well, it's just brain chemistry and whatever. Like, those people are saying, oh, actually, there is real going on here.
Right.
There's real stuff going on here. So I read those studies and I said, Okay. Well, let's for a moment suppose that these people aren't crazy. They're not stupid. Very smart people say this, you know, that these are real entities, real beings. So my question was like, who are they then? Right? Like if they're real beings, if we're really contacting these entities, who are the entities? Right. And you go on Joe Rogan, like Joe Rogan talks about that all the time. I'm like, who are they? Are they aliens or whatever? And like, that's an interesting question. And it's an important question because more and more people are doing this drug and other psychedelics. And then, so the question is, okay, who are they and what do they want? Right. So that was the next question I had in my mind. Now, and I feel free to interrupt all you want, but because I know I'm going on a long rant, but
oh, no worries.
Yeah. The next thing that blew my mind was this, Lucas. I was trained in Koine Greek, which is the language of the New Testament, because I went to seminary. But I wasn't very good at it. I got a B in that class and was happy to graduate.
That's pretty good. That's pretty all right. Good.
And so I know a little bit of Koine Greek. But I didn't realize this. And so as I was thinking about this psychedelics, et cetera, I started to Google, like, what does the Bible say about drugs? And the crazy thing is the first page of Google results were, what does the Bible say about drugs? And you click on the link and it basically said, the Bible doesn't say anything about drugs. The answer was that the Bible says that, you know, being drunk is bad. Therefore we think taking drugs is bad because like, it's probably the same thing. The Bible talks about being sober. And so you have to like, not be so. And so,
then the question kind of begs itself, if we're equating the two and we know that Jesus made wine, it seems like he also meant when he's talking about John the Baptist, they said John the Baptist was crazy. They say John the Baptist was crazy because he didn't drink. They say that I'm a drunkard because I drink wine.
Yeah.
So then would Jesus do drugs? Like, that doesn't answer the question.
Yeah, right, right. It does not answer the question. Not only that, but like, if that was true, you could say that Christians are, you know, the Bible has more warnings about wine than drugs, right? Like you could say Christians should do drugs instead of wine. Now here's the wild thing, Lucas. Like I was like, okay, that's weird. Why are Christians more prone? You go to a church picnic, and unless you're at certain denominations, people have beer at the church picnic. Why don't people have ayahuasca at the church picnic? Right? Like, why don't I have, you know? So, and then I learned something that I should have known from my Greek study. You know what the word in Greek for drugs is? The word is pharmakia, which makes sense, right? That's where we get the word pharmacy. It's where we get the word pharmaceuticals. Pharmakia is the Greek, Koine Greek word, which you see in the New Testament at various points. So it's actually throughout the Old Testament and through the New Testament, the word pharmakia pops up over and over again. But you Google the Bible for drugs and it doesn't pop up. Do you know why? It doesn't pop up in the Bible.
I don't know.
Because they translate it a different way. Do you know what word they translate it to?
I do not remember, no.
They translate it to witchcraft. The word for drugs and the word for witchcraft are the same word in the Koine Greek. The same word, Koine is the type of Greek they spoke in the ancient world. So it's a little different from modern Greek. The same word, you look up the lexicons and the same word is used. Now, it's one thing you could say is, okay, well, they translated it witchcraft because that's a better translation. And we have all kinds of words in English where like the word bark can mean the outer layer of a tree. It can also mean the sound a dog makes, right? So you could say, well, that's fine, but we have experts to translate the Bible. And they said it was witchcraft, not drugs. And therefore it's not really relevant to the drug discussion, but that's not the case. That's not the case in this case, because actually all the lexicons are like a modern day dictionary we've come up with to define what ancient words said. And in all the lexicons, the word drug is in there. So it's not like, witchcraft or drugs is the proper translation of the word. The witchcraft of the day had drugs as an integral part. Mm. So shaman would take drugs or give drugs to the people they were working with to see the visions that they saw. And that was so common that it became part of the word. The idea of witchcraft and drug taking were tied up together. So what the lexicons often say the proper translation for the word pharmakia is not just witchcraft. If you look up the lexicon, it will say to administer drugs for spiritual purposes. That literally is the translation in some of the lexicons, right? Or the magical use of drugs.
Yep.
I'm sorry. So real quick. When you take that translation, right, which is just the full translation of the word as found in the modern day lexicons, when you take that translation, and then you start looking at what the Bible says about drugs or this magical use of drugs, spiritual use of drugs, the administering of drugs for spiritual purposes. At that point in time, the warnings against drugs become insane, like mind-blowing, insane warnings, where the Bible says, and I'm trying to get to this in my book, but it'll say, do not allow the person that takes drugs for spiritual purposes to live.
Yep.
Right. It will say, do not allow. Yeah. So like the warnings are mind-blowingly strong once you realize that's the translation of that word.
Well, and so to our earlier conversation about what DMT is doing, it's a portal to this weird place where these elves and shapes and everything. I think there was another, you made a really good point in the book, I think, about we can associate what's happening on these trips, these psychedelic journeys, with seeing this sort of the underbelly of the spiritual realm. And I like the connection you're talking about the serpent specifically, that there across culture, one of the things that people tend to see also with the elves and the shapes, geometry, is the serpent, which in Christian mythology or in the Bible, the serpent that's where the original sin, the downfall of humanity, we see this image of a serpent. So it would make sense to associate, to make these connections between people taking these psychedelic trips, seeing all this weird stuff. Let's assume it's real for a second, and they're also seeing a serpent figure. Is this a portal to a dark spirituality? And that's why the Bible warns against it.
Yes, that is the terrifying part. So, I have a chapter called The Serpent and the Sacrifice, where I started off with a quote from Graham Hancock. And he says the following. He talks about his own use of ayahuasca. And he says, very commonly, these entities appear as serpents or as serpent-human hybrids. Mother ayahuasca herself is frequently depicted as a serpent. I have met her in this form many times. So here, Graham Hancock is saying, hey, I've interacted with the serpent. And And she's wise. She's wonderful. She's a serpent human hybrid. And I don't know, Lucas, if I'm the C.S. Lewis geek here. So have you read Narnia recently? And in particular, the Silver Chair.
I remember that story. Yes.
So if you remember from the Silver Chair, the bad guy is the woman, and she's a woman that's a serpent human hybrid.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
And like there's this theme, and C.S. Lewis was a expert in medieval mythology. And so he didn't just come up with that idea. That was a theme he pulled from medieval mythology. So this idea of the serpent human hybrid goes back to the Middle Ages. And what I speculated in my book is that it's a reflection on this pharmakia that they were coming up against as Christianity expanded into the the woods of Northern Europe and yep. throughout the world.
Well, historically, people who trip on this stuff see it. People today who trip on it report seeing it. And we see it like so to all that together, yeah, it's interesting how the Bible, the Christian worldview, allows you to see a clear picture of what's going on here. It's not just random aberrations. Why is there a pattern here? And why is there so much consistency with what we're seeing here?
Okay. Want to know the next insane part of this? It was like the third insane part. Okay. So there's this drug, and this drug shows entities, and the Bible has all these strong prohibitions. They seem strange. Like, why does the Bible don't allow the person that uses drugs for spiritual purposes? That's crazy. And then you hear like what you just mentioned is there's this common theme, especially on ayahuasca, but also other drugs, of serpents that you see and interact with. The deities come in many forms, but one of them is serpents. And throughout the ancient Middle East, Near East, like the region of the Bible, and throughout almost every region, you find these serpent gods. Here's the mind blowing thing. So when I read a book called The Serpent Symbol in the Ancient Near East, it was by a professor at Yale. Maybe I'm probably getting the school wrong, but, a guy named Leslie Wilson. And he talks about the serpent symbol in depth. And one of the things he says in there is that, the serpent deity and human sacrifice are an axiom or a datum. That's what he says. They're a datum. Like that their association is undeniable. That when you run up against the serpent deity in the ancient Near East, and you run into this and you see human sacrifice go along with it. And that's when you study, like in the Bible, it's got like the Baal and Asherah. Many of them are depicted as serpents at the same time. So, you know, the serpent and the human sacrifice.
Those deities required child sacrifice.
Right, yeah. And that's the crazy thing. So like in the Bible, when you go through, and by the way, I'm quoting Old Testament passages here. The Old Testament was not written in Koine Greek. It was written in Hebrew. But what I talk about in my book is that there was an Old Testament translation to Koine Greek called the Septuagint. And that translation would have been what the apostles use. And actually you see them quote from that. We can tell because of the particular translation and order of the words and stuff that they were quoting from the Septuagint. So that Septuagint has these warnings using that word pharmakia, which is a Greek word, not a Hebrew word. And you mentioned this a second ago, often those, it will warn against pharmakia, and then in the next sentence, or even in the same sentence, it will say, or sacrifice your children in the fire. Do not use pharmakia or burn your children in the fire. They'll say this king was bad because he practiced pharmakia and he burned his children in the fire. So there's this warning throughout the Bible of like, don't use drugs for spiritual purposes, and don't sacrifice your children in the fire.
Well, and in the modern era, you know, trying to make that connection to what's happening today in America, we had the 60s and 70s, this drug psychedelic revolution, and Roe versus Wade, 1973, now we're sacrificing children. Go ahead.
Yeah. You want to know something crazy about that, Lucas, is okay. So we had, early feminism was actually anti-abortion. That's an interesting historical fact. They were against abortion. So we had this psychedelic revolution in the 1950s and 60s, early 70s. And all of a sudden we're doing abortion, right? Like all of a sudden feminism flips and they say, actually, we want to do abortion. It's a woman's right. Right. So like there was a giant flip in sentimentality, but coming from the same people that were into this counterculture movement, doing psychedelics, et cetera. But what I found was that the connection actually goes way further back. So in the largest abortion provider today in America is called Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood was founded by Margaret Sanger. Mm-hmm. Margaret Sanger she was not a very nice lady. She was into eugenics and other not good stuff.
Racist.
Right. But a lot of people will say, well, yeah, but she founded Planned Parenthood and they didn't offer abortions. They were
women's health.
A birth control organization. They yeah. weren't about abortion. But here's the crazy thing is like, she actually was pro-abortion when everybody else was, you know, of the day, anti-abortion, but she was told to dial down her message because it wouldn't work. And the guy that warned her, man, I'm blanking on his name, but she had a mentor. And the guy that warned her was, and I'll look up his name as we're going here, but the guy that warned her, her mentor, she spent time with in England. I think he was even maybe her lover as well. Here, I'm going to look up the name just so I can have, so I can have the details as well.
We love citing our sources on this.
Yeah. Okay. So, podcast. So her mentor was a guy named Havelock Ellis, and he's got a Wikipedia page, famous guy. So Havelock Ellis, was a pioneer in psychedelics.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a pioneer in psychedelics. He experimented with them personally. He was an expert on them. He promoted them. He also was into the occult. And he advised Margaret Sanger, and they came up with the plan for Planned Parenthood together.
With the end goal being abortion.
Yeah. He said, yeah, they were in agreement that abortion was a good thing.
Mm.
And they just thought that it would alienate too many people if they came out of the gate pro-abortion.
Gotcha. It's
so, and now that plan has worked very well. Abortion yep. legal almost everywhere. Planned Parenthood doing all of the abortion, right? So,
it is crazy that we're living in a time when there's pushback now. Roe v. Wade is overturned. States are having different whatever. But go ahead.
No, yeah, I mean it's a crazy moment for sure. Yeah,
but then connecting everything that you do in your book, drug culture with abortion, if the church fails to push back on drug culture, are we going to fail in our efforts on pro-life movements as well?
I think so, absolutely. Like I'll say this. I think that the whole premise of the book is this, is that what you interact with when you do psychedelics, whether it's you actually see Mother Ayahuasca herself coming in the form of a serpent, or whether it's just a spiritual experience on psychedelics, what you interact with is something. And that's what, if you read the psychedelic literature, people say that over and over again. Terrence McKenna, who's like a psychedelic pioneer, Terrence McKenna says, there's something there that's desperately trying to contact us. Something there that's desperately trying to contact us. And what, if we take that as real, which I kind of make the case in my book, I think it is real. Like, you have to like acknowledge that we're bumping into something real. Like people that do this stuff say that over and over again, that no, there's something real there. If we take it as real, then the question is like, what do they want? And what I make the case for in the book is that at least historically, they want not good stuff. Like they're not interested. They don't have human best interests in mind, right? Like they have an agenda, but it's not an agenda that is really in our best interest.
You look historically at societies, cultures that have psychedelics as a part of their society, there's also human sacrifice. You don't find one without the other.
Yeah. And that's a funny thing. So going back to Joe Rogan, so on his podcast, he and Graham Hancock were talking about ayahuasca, and they said, wouldn't it be great if we could get all our politicians to take ayahuasca? Like, they'd be so much more enlightened. They'd be so much better off if they all had taken ayahuasca. And as I heard that, I'm like, we've tried that before. It's called the Inca, and they enslaved millions of people, and they like had butchery on a level that we've never seen before. And they sacrificed children in the fire and in all other types of ways at an industrial rate. So we've tried that before. We have had politicians that all took ayahuasca, and yeah, it did not turn out point. Well. Yeah, so
well, and even it, psychedelics in its most benign, like people who just trip and they have a spiritual experience and they're more enlightened. What when they describe this new enlightenment that they have, it's usually like a bunch of niceties, like it's like a bunch of like deep or deepities. I'm stealing that word from Daniel Dennett. Deepities, where you say something that sounds profound, but if you examine it, it's actually very shallow and bland. Like, we're all just part of the same universe. Like, yes, we know that we're all, you know, love is the only thing. Like, when you hear people talk about what this infinite wisdom that they saw on this other side, it's not usually anything that's super profound. Like, nobody's coming from these experiences with the cure for cancer or, you know, what, you know, whatever.
So let me say, I want to clarify to anybody listening that this book is not a religious book. So I make this book is a secular book. I don't write it from, I mean, obviously I'm a Christian writing from a Christian perspective, but I don't make like a biblical case of here's why it's wrong, you know, God or whatever. Like, I'm making the case of like, let's take the science of like, what are these things? Let's take the, what atheists say they are when they see them, what scientists, to the best of their knowledge, what they are.
Let's take it at face value.
Take it at face value, acknowledge what it is, and then ask that question of who are the entities, what do they want, and what's historically, what have they done? And that's the kind of the giant question mark that we have there. So there's that I wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
And then in it, to get to your question of like, you know, these basic, you know, what do we, you know, the pushback for me would be, you know, what people would say is like, hey, Lewis, there's people, I took LSD and I had a spiritual experience. I learned to love everybody and it made me a better person, right? Like, that's what Joe Rogan would say, is like, I didn't come off of my psychedelic trip by wanting to murder babies, right? I came off my psychedelic trip and I discovered that I really love my wife, or I really love my best friend. Like, he is my,
I'm just grateful, like, to be alive.
Grateful to be alive, right? And so like, that's the pushback, will be like, yeah, you're describing old societies that may have been crazy anyway, and it didn't, you know, like, didn't refer to that. But what you just touched on is a very important point. So one of the promises of LSD, like when you hear people talk about the benefits, one of the promises that Joe Rogan talks about, Mike Cernovich talks about this, is that it makes you a better person. That, you know, you take the LSD or you take the psilocybin or magic mushrooms or whatever, and you come down and you say, I have a better understanding of this life. I'm a better person. But the specifics, as soon as you get skeptical, like you just did, that all falls apart. So when you say, okay, in what way are you a better person? Okay. And what, like, did you contribute more to charity? Did you, reconciled with your wife that you divorced? Have you, you know, are you more generous? You know, like, in what specific ways? And can we put some science on this? Can we say, hey, here's people that did LSD a lot, and they're like this, they're starting these charitable organizations, and those stupid non-sober people, or the sober people, they never start charities. Are they, you know, the LSD people, they're the ones that are donating all the money to the poor, and like, the sober people, they donate nothing. Like, there's no science to that. There's zero science. And when you start asking specific questions, okay, like, what did you learn? And it'll be like, I learned I need to love everybody. And it's like, you didn't know that before? Like, you didn't realize before you took the drug that you should actually love everybody? So the insights they learn are, and actually Michael Pollan, who's a big advocate of LSD, he favors LSD. He wrote How to Change Your Mind. Very interesting book. Warning, it's pro drugs, but he admits in that book that the lessons we learn from psychedelics are Hallmark greetings, right? Yep. So there's something you would find on a Hallmark card. It's like, I love everybody, or like, I realize you mean a lot to me, right? Like, they're just like, they're phrases that for the most part we knew already. And but then the other thing that I talk about in the last chapter of my book, and hopefully I'm not spoiling the book too much for people. There's a lot more in the book, I will say, and the case is made in a lot more detail, and it's a very interesting book. So nothing we're talking about here at fully spoils the book. It's definitely worth listening to or reading. But what I talk about in the last chapter of the book is even the banal stuff, even the Hallmark greetings. If you take the spiritual things that we interact with, and I make the point in the book that just because you're not seeing an entity, let's say you take LSD and you, rather than seeing a Mother Ayahuasca, you have an experience, a spiritual experience. That phrase, spiritual experience, we still need to ask the question, who are the entities? We should say, who are the spirits? Because in the ancient world, they didn't take every spirit as good. Like in modern America, we say, oh, I had a spiritual experience. And you say, oh, that's great. I'm so glad you had a spiritual experience. But like in the ancient world, they would say, oh, that's interesting. What spirit?
Yeah.
Right. Like, was it a good spirit or bad spirit? Yeah. What kind of spirit did you interact with? And when you ask that question of like, okay, I had a spiritual experience on LSD, and someone says, well, was it a good spirit or a bad spirit? And I say, well, it told me I should quit my job and become a Zen Buddhist teacher. And they'd be like, well, whether or not that was a good decision depends very much on who that spirit was, right? Yeah. Like, it depends on, like, if that was a spirit from the angel of God, that was absolutely the right decision. But if that was a bad spirit, if that was a spirit that's tricky, if that was a spirit that hates humans, if that was a spirit that has bad designs for society, if that was not a good spirit, your decision to do that was the opposite of an admirable thing. It was actually a really bad decision.
The ancient world was much more apt to employ discernment whereas today there's no discernment at all. Oh, a spiritual experience. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a giant problem. And that's one of one of the lessons from my book, I would hope people get is that question. So.
And you know, you're opening doors, right? Like, I love the point about it's a secular take on, you know, hey, let's look at the scientific research and take at face value what these participants in psychedelics are experiencing, and then start to question what's the nature of these entities, what might be their motives, and using the, so I think a secular audience will enjoy your book. I also think Christian leaders would really benefit because looking at the pharmakia, the association of witchcraft and psychedelics, because historically there has been a, like in the church, this prohibition against drugs, psychedelics, marijuana, all that stuff. But it's starting to kind of soften up, like people are changing their attitudes. And you make a good case that no, like there's this prohibition is this historic prohibition the church has always had. Is very, very important to maintain.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The I have a chapter there on kind of the Christian interaction with pharmakia as it expanded throughout the world. And there was a kind of a, in some ways, a horrible reaction that Christians had, which was witch hunts. So you think of a witch, and the iconography there is very interesting. One is there. Mixing a brew in the woods, which was a Dionysian thing. So a Greek, you know, they would take psychedelic medicines and mix those in the woods as a women's ritual. That's a very, it's most likely some kind of Dionysian remnants witchcraft was as they expanded into Northern Europe. And then there was witch hunts, right? So they wouldn't destroy temples, destroy practicers of witchcraft, et cetera, et cetera. And I talk about my book as like, obviously that was not good, but their reaction was very understandable. If you lived in a society where human sacrifice was common, and it was common because there was entities and spirits that you interacted with while on psychedelics and while doing witchcraft out in the woods, it is understandable that you would very much not want people doing that anymore. Not because you're, you know, like you read most people and they think, oh, they banned witchcraft because it was competition to Christianity and they didn't want, you know, they didn't think that they couldn't compete. Like that's what literally what like Michael Pollan says and Brian Murescu and these guys, they're like, well, Christianity just couldn't compete. And that's why they banned them because it's a more spiritual experience for them. No, would it like what I speculate in the book is like, what if they were insane about witchcraft because they remember their own grandchildren being killed in the fire? Like what if their concerns were not like this petty, I want my religion to win, but that religion is dangerous as hell. Like what if that was the reaction? And in which case, again, I still don't support like killing witches, but like it's much more understandable. Their strong reaction is much more understandable if you take that as the premise.
Right. If those witches are conducting human sacrifice, then I'm open to a capital punishment conversation.
Yeah.
They're not the same thing, right? They're not all religions are created equal. Regarding Christianity and paganism, one believes the life of children are sacred. The other does not. That's a profound difference among many differences, but that's a very profound difference.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize this, but one of the reasons, if you read like Rodney Stark, and this is not related to my topic, but it kind of is related to my topic. But if you read Rodney Stark, like The Rise of Christianity, he talks about the fact that one of the reasons Christianity grew, we assume that it grew by conversion and then it grew by government mandate, right? But in reality, one of the reasons it grew is Christians had children. They got married, they had children. And you say, well, why didn't the Romans? Romans did lots of sex. Why didn't they have children? Well, they practiced infanticide at an epic rate. Yeah. That's what people don't realize. In ancient Rome, you didn't want a kid, you killed it. You know, in a lot of places there was a big gender difference because the females were not profitable to the family. So, you know, someone has a kid and you kill the girl, right? So it was very common to take your children and leave them out to exposure or to drown them when you had them, if you felt you couldn't afford a baby. So like, there's all this, concern in the Roman government in the first few centuries of the church, or first few centuries of the AD, that the Roman population is dropping and that it's hurting their economy and it's hurting their world. And what Christianity brought was a sense of the nuclear family sense. You can't kill your baby girls. You know, you can't kill, you know, you can't kill. And that sense of life actually is one of the reasons that Christianity grew, and it's to get into your part is a pretty amazing fact, and it speaks to kind of this whole concept of
why Christianity is superior to
how it's different. Yeah,
and another book on that, How Christianity Changed the World, talks about it. Yeah, the Roman era infanticide. So if you're a Roman man and you want a wife, you have to strongly consider pursuing a Christian, because the Christian families were the ones that were keeping their girls.
Yeah.
That were not aborting them, killing them. And those wives would then become mothers, and imposing their Christian values on the Roman household would have Christian children. And just, it's crazy how women, specifically mothers, mothers are the people talk about having the biggest impact on their society.
Yeah.
Being a Christian mom historically seems to have the biggest impact on societies.
Yeah, it's interesting when you look back on kind of the ancient Roman world, how many times the emperor is not Christian, but he's got a Christian wife, or he's got a Christian mother.
Constantine.
Constantine's a great example where it's like they're that theme that you just touched on, because Christian men were not killing their baby girls. As a result, there was all these Christian women that were eligible. So you also had a lot of flirt and converts, right? So you had a lot of people that were forced to convert to Christianity in order to get a wife. And so it was, and I say forced, you know, they probably did it voluntarily, but there was an incentive to join the church that you could find a wife. And that's another reason Christianity grew. So,
yep. Which I know now we're starting to get outside, but this just prompts so many interesting conversations. So yeah, check out Lewis's book. Pre-sale's going on right now. Learn about what DMT is. Not just this recreational, hey, try this, have some cool experiences. You're open. Look at the scientific literature, the consistency with which you see other entities. Realize that you're opening doors to these things. Look at Lewis makes a great case why historically you can associate drug culture with infanticide, and in our modern era, abortion, and you know why we should, and the pharmakia conversation, looking at the Bible and where it's translated witchcraft, and we should actually be reading that, associating that with drug culture. So very, very, very interesting book, Lewis. I'm very excited for people to check it out, and maybe it'll help start changing the conversation that the church is having with drugs.
I sure hope so. I mean, the normalization of psychedelics is happening so fast, right? Like I tell my kids, like, we'll drive around and I'll tell my kids, I'll be like, when I was a kid, all the billboards were against drugs. Now they're all for drugs.
Yep. Yeah.
Right. Like you see a billboard and it's like, pot here, you can stop. You know, I don't know what state you are in, but in Michigan, like it's because marijuana is legal. Every billboard is for drugs. It's ridiculous. Yep. Like it's very, very common. And states are, the legalization of marijuana is happening at an epic pace.
Yeah.
The legalization of other psychedelics is happening quickly.
Yes.
You know, just 20 years ago to even study it was not easily permitted. Like it was hard if you were an academic to even have a psychedelic study, let alone for it to be legal places. But now there's a legalization push for psychedelics. There's a big argument that it's got medical use. If you remember, that's kind of how marijuana got legalized, was they started with, hey, let's legalize it for medical purposes. And everybody's like, oh, okay, sounds good. And then recreational followed right on the heels.
Well, I know I think the conversation is going to accelerate even this particular football season. Aaron Rodgers, quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, he's dating a witch. Her name is Blue Earth right now. They're dating. He's been talking about this preseason. He has experimented heavily with psychedelics and is looking forward to an improved football season. So that I know that's going to be
ayahuasca in particular.
He took ayahuasca in particular.
Yeah.
So I know. So the football audience, for our European audience, I'm sorry, we're appropriating the term football to describe something that is not
American football. The real football.
a more conservative audience that watches American football spectators are now going to be talking about psychedelics in a different way this football season because of that. I think it's very timely that your book is coming out, and
that's why I wrote it. Like I'm desperate for this message to get out. Like I'm desperate for to be the person putting up a warning sign, because I feel like the culture as a whole isn't creeping towards widespread acceptance of psychedelics. It is barreling towards it. It's happening so fast. It's happening as fast as the whole, you know, like I find it shocking how quick the whole LGBT thing happened, where it's just like, if you go back to the 1990s, a majority of the population wanted sodomy to be legal. Like, it just changed like overnight. Like, it was 20 years. Like, all of a sudden it went from like that to like we're having pride parades and like, it just, it's crazy how quickly that changed. This is changing just as quickly, and it's not getting as much press because the church isn't fighting it. Like, the church doesn't know, like I said, you know, Google, what does the Bible say about drugs? And it doesn't even come up, right? Like,
right.
The church isn't fighting this one. So this one's happening even easier. And they're following the model that they use for marijuana. The same thing is like, oh, there's all
that sort of libertarian, like, yeah, hey, just let, you know, let, well, if they're not hurting anybody.
Right. Yeah. That's part of it. But also the medicinal path. So they're saying, listen, you know, there's all kinds of therapeutic uses for psychedelics. You know, there's all kinds of good uses. It'll help you with your anxiety. It'll help you with this. It'll help you with that. There's a medical benefit. Psychotherapy is now using psychedelics and being very effective. It helps you quit smoking. It helps, like, the number of valuable things to this are great. We should just legalize it for those purposes. And then, you know, that the next thing that will happen is it'll be legalized for recreational purposes. Like, so it's exactly what happened with marijuana, which was, hey, we should legalize marijuana. Who are you to tell someone dying of cancer they shouldn't take marijuana? And everybody's like, yeah, that sounds reasonable to me. And then,
yeah, boom, it's not hurting me, I guess.
And then boom, it's legalized for recreational purposes. And that's definitely happening, going to happen with psychedelics, unless someone puts up the warning sign. So, like, that's what my book is like. Death, and you can hear the passion in my voice. I'm usually the quiet one on this podcast, but like, I care so much about this subject. And it's once you take the premise as true that these entities are real things, you don't have to follow any of the other religious stuff. But once you take that as true, it becomes terrifying when you think that Terrence McKenna line where he says there's an entity out there that's trying to reach us, as desperate to reach us. Once you ask that question of like, okay,
what's their intention?
If that's real, who are they and what do they want?
Yeah.
And like, what are they doing? And by the way, we as a society are going to let them reach us now. Like, we as a society have legalized pot. We've legalized ayahuasca. We mainstream this stuff. The biggest podcaster out there, Joe Rogan, is talking about it every day. The biggest quarterback in the NFL is now talking about and bragging about it and saying it's a performance enhancing drug. Like, as a culture, we're saying, do drugs. Go do drugs. Yeah. And it's
do drugs to be a good moral person.
Right. And if the entities are real, that's a terrifying thing. Like, that's a terror. That, who are we letting out of the Pandora's box idea? Like, who are we letting out of the box? Like, what are these things and why are we letting them out? Is a frightening idea.
Indeed. Well, thank you for writing the book. Thank you for talking about it, Lewis. Very excited to see how it does. Like and subscribe. We'll find this on, obviously we're on YouTube, on wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a like, rate us, let us know what you think. We really appreciate it. As always, I'll set up a Twitter thread, summarize like all the books. If you're interested in the books that Lewis cites, I'll cite that in the thread so you can go check it out for yourself.
You can also pre-order the book or to learn more detail about the book, just go to my Substack. I'll have the link to it and everything there. So lewisungit.substack.com. I'll have all the details and also like other interesting stuff I learned on the subject. I've got other articles and stuff up there. So definitely go to that page.
Awesome. Thanks, Lewis. All right. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.